I actually saw you in Florida on Lollapalooza. I think it was 1992-ish.
Yeah, I
saw you guys in maybe Orlando. Might have been Orlando.
Yeah, that was a good show. That was a fun show.
Yeah, that was one of your first big shows, right? Or were you on tour before that?
No, we were on tour before that. We had toured with the Peppers when I was in Pearl Jam for the Lollapalooza thing and in the States. And we were doing some, you know, it started off like 5,000. And then as we blew up and they blew up and Smashing Pumpkins blew up, we were playing bigger shows. A few years at Cal Palace we did together with Nirvana, and then a couple other shows. Those were, you know, 25,000. And then we did Pink Pop already at that point, which was 5,000. So yeah, we'd already kind of popped our proverbial large crowd cherry at that point. So
yeah.
Lollapalooza was such a treat, man. What a great summer.
Yeah, I remember that show. It was you guys and Soundgarden was there, I believe.
And Ice Cube and Jesus and Mary Chain and Lush and Ministry, and Ice Cube was awesome. That, man, it was just great. That was a great summer. Probably everybody that I'm still in touch with, I mean, every time that comes up or there's a photo, every one of us, it's like a knee-jerk reaction. Wow, that was a great summer, you know? But for Pearl Jam, it was an incredible summer. I mean, we played for 30, 35 minutes at 2 in the afternoon because we signed on before stuff blew up. So, I mean, it was awesome. It was like, go, you know, give it all you got. And then you had the whole rest of the day to steal boats and go fishing and watch other bands and hang out.
Yeah. Did you do a lot of documenting back then? Did you take a lot of photos and stuff?
You know, I was blessed with parents that taught me at a young age to pay attention. You know, that if stuff sucked, pay attention because you'll learn from it. And if stuff's fantastic, pay attention because you'll want to remember it. You know, and so, you know, I still to this day, 9 times out of 10, if I hear a crowd noise, I know if Pearl Jam crowd was back then or not. You know, I remember every show. But on that tour, before that tour had happened, you know, we'd already sold a bunch of records, and we were in Sony's very good graces. So they were giving us the coolest shit. Like, you know, all of a sudden before Lollapalooza, they gave us all the state of the art, you know, that they were back then, the Hi-8 tape, you know, little handy cam. And I carried a camera around a lot. And so, yeah, we were documenting a lot of shit.
That's fun. That's fun. Man.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great.
Now,
it was awesome.
Now, let's go back a little bit. You had mentioned your parents. Were they pretty supportive of your decision to go into the music business?
Oh, man. I mean, first of all, you got to understand you're talking about drummer's parents. You know, they were supportive they were supportive of me expressing myself with sticks, you know, on a very loud instrument in my teenage and younger bedroom, just, you know, and the bands practiced there. And so they were incredibly, I don't know if supportive is the right word, patient and tolerant.
Yes.
The first and foremost. And understanding and a little oblivious. And, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff there. But in that it all, I guess, sums up to be they were supportive. You know, when I was a kid, I had informed them that, you know, that I wanted, I you know, this is what I wanted. You know, I saw the band Triumph. Remember Triumph, the Canadian rock band?
Sure.
I saw them at Reunion Arena, and some particular time, you know, I'd already been bitten by the bug. I got to touch Angus Young's leg back in Black Tour, one of my first concerts I ever went to.
Got his leg.
You know, and yeah, we walked around. I jumped over the rail onto the floor, and Brian Johnson was carrying around, and I touched his leg. And I saw Ted Nugent a bunch of times, and you know, Van Halen, and I mean, you know, incredible time music that late 70s, early 80s time. Saw Journey and Warner and all these great bands. But at this one particular show of Triumph, Gil Moore, the drummer, had his kick drum going on his disco ball kit. Boom, boom, boom. And the lights came up, and there was 12,500 people all fist in the air, you know. And I was at about mid-court at the arena, and I just looked around. I remember that voice in my head that was actually my voice saying, wow, I want to do that. That's what I want. So I let them know, you know, I mean, I think they already knew because it's all I did between, you know, baseball and drumming. And I let them know that, you know, I felt like I could always go back. I'm getting old. Sorry. I could always go back to school and stuff. Excuse me. But I wanted to play pro. And you know, the way I put it to him was that I could always reevaluate my life. I'm 25. This is a 12, 13-year-old kid talking. I could always reevaluate my life and go back to school and stuff, but I've got to give it a shot. So. And I remember calling, you know, it was right around the eve of my 25th birthday. I was one of the headliners in front of 2,500 people with all of my heroes, Terry Bozzio, Louis Bellson, Ginger Baker, all these guys, headlining the Modern Drummer Festival. And I called my folks up and I said, well, what the hell, you know?
Yeah, I think it did.
So, yeah, so in that, you know, but I really, you know, I didn't know what I was really getting into. You know, like none of my family or friend, nobody was in the industry or anything. I just had to play. That's all there was to it. You know, it was the only time I felt connected to anything or even myself when I was grown.
Mm-hmm. Now, and the way you found yourself into Pearl Jam was, I thought, pretty interesting because Matt Chamberlain, you knew him, right? How did you guys know each other?
Well, Matt and I, we didn't really know each other at the time. We knew of each other. He was a founding member of a really great band called Ten Hands, which, you know, I kidnapped a couple of members of Ten Hands in my Green Romance Orchestra project after program, but they were, to me, the most incredible vocal band in the Dallas area. You know, Earl Harbin, another great drummer, Mike Dillon and Matt Earl were just incredible, you know, and Gary Muller played the Chapman Stick, which was new on the scene and played it so well. It was just such an intense, rhythmic, entertaining and musical band. And Matt got taken out of that band and went on tour with Edie Brickell and Bohemian. And so when Matt split to go off with Edie, he was doing a lot of sessions with a producer named David Castell. And so all of a sudden there was a void, and Dave started calling me. So, you know, it was kind of like I was following where Matt left his footprints. I was, you know, kind of stepping in his place. And he was on tour with Pearl Jam. They just hired him, you know, Dave Cruzan and the band parted ways, and they hired Matt. They had this showcase kind of a tour thing going on. And Matt, while they were in New York, got asked to join the G. Smith band for Saturday Night Live, and that was more aligned with what he wanted to do with his career. And so he was back in Dallas, and he was Mike Dillon, and they were at a bar, Main Bar, and my band, the band I was in, Dr. Tongue, we were playing that night, and they just happened to come in. And, you know, Matt was like, he's kind of in the spot. He's like, you know, he was talking to Mike about leaving Pearl Jam gig. He didn't want to leave them hanging. So they're kind of like, who could I recommend? Blah, blah, blah. And Mike pointed out, well, what about Dave? You know, because we have playing. And so, you know, it's a funny story, because that night on the way home, my snare drum bounced out of the back of my Ranchero. I stopped at a stoplight. My snare drum was passed. So I was like, oh, fuck. And at that point, you know, I had been playing since I was a little kid, and I just felt like, I kind of felt like, you know, I played it out. I didn't know where else to go. I mean, the guys I was playing with, to me, were top game, and they were the guys I wanted to play with. But again, we didn't have any, you know, Illuminati connections or parents in the industry or anything. So I remember getting home, and, you know, I had made my $50 from the gig, and I knew it was going to cost me more than that to replace the two cymbals I broke trying to impress Mike and Matt. And my snare drum just rolled across the fucking hot. You know, I was just like, man. And it was the first time in my life that I had, instead of setting my drums up in my little one-car sand floor garage where we rehearsed, I stacked them up in the corner of the living room. I sat there and I sat that night. And I maybe I'm, this is, you know, I just couldn't see any way to break through to the next level. And I just kind of thought, you know, yeah, maybe it's time. And the next day, the phone bill was due. And it was like, I was like $4 short. And I had sold my bicycle. I was still $4 short. Friend of mine bought my last joint for $3, and I found the rest of it in the couch cushions. And I walked the place and I paid my phone bill. And when I was walking back home, when I got to the front yard, starting up the sidewalk, I heard the phone ring. Hey, the phone's on. And I went in and I picked it up, and it was Matt. Hey, man, you know, you want to check out the band Pearl Jam? But it was that close to, like, you know, I mean, for the first time I decided, eh. And then, you know, again, all those chains of events the next morning of paying my phone bill. And then, you know, as soon as if anything would have been different, you know, I would have called. But Matt had called Dave Castell and got my number, and then called and asked me if I'd be interested in checking the band out.
Wow. So you were this close to hanging it up.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. But, you know, that might not have lasted, you know, but that's how
I
felt.
Yeah. I mean, it's sure, but yeah. Everything could, your trajectory could have been totally different.
Yeah. If I wouldn't have sold that doobie, or if I would have smoked it instead of going to pay the phone bill, you know, whatever it was. It's amazing how things work. And, you know, and it, yeah, I remember that feeling of, like, you know, when I hung up the phone and I thought, the fuck is Pearl Jam?
Yeah, and, yeah, yeah.
Mother love, what? I don't know anything about that.
Because you know? You're in Texas and they're in Seattle, right?
Well, yeah, and it just wasn't my kind of thing. You know? I mean, it wasn't the kind of music I listened to. I remember when Soundgarden had come through Dallas, you know, but I just thought they had a cool name. I never heard it. You know what I mean? It was just, I was more into local music and Sapa and, you know, Parliament. And, you know, I was getting all these guys, Doug Neal and Robert Cooper and you know, Joey Ellis and Brian Todd, all these people, and my friend John Anderson, they were all turning me on to all this new music. And just, yeah, I was way off the old.
Okay, after you got that phone call, how soon did you head out to Seattle?
Oh, man.
I mean, was it fairly quickly or?
It was fairly quickly. Yeah, they were in a rush for sure. I mean, they were checking out, auditioning different people and all that. Pat Mastelotto played with them for a minute, a bunch of different people. But yeah, I went up a few weeks later. And at that point, you know, I wasn't really that thank. I wasn't really that into it. I wasn't very even really excited about it. You know, I tried to make it through the 10 record when I was listening to the demo or the cassette they sent me to learn the songs. And at one point I actually called and asked Eddie and Jeff if they wanted to learn, you know, to come up and play the songs as they were on this cassette. And if they would have said yes, I would have said no, I wasn't.
Really? You didn't like it that much?
It was years. I was in the band for years before I actually listened to a full song off.
When you got there, you guys just started jamming and you just did your own thing to those?
Yeah, songs? they said just come up and let's just jam. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we went out, I went up and I was playing on Mac Kit, and that's what introduced me to the drum, because he had left the drum set up there. And we played and hung out and didn't really mess with the songs. Like every once in a while, we played one, but yeah, damn it. Then it was I was supposed to go back home on Saturday, and on Thursday, we were leaving the rehearsal room, and I asked Eddie, I said, so, you know, when I leave here, am I going to know I've got a gig? Or, and he said, well, I think we're going to check out a couple other people. And I went back to the room I was staying in, and I thought, that doesn't sit well with me. So when I woke up the next day, I called the management office, and I was going to tell Kelly that, you know, that I was going to split, you know, because it wasn't worth hanging around another 2 days. If they were auditioning other people, I didn't want the gig because the other people weren't. So I called the office and he answered the phone. He said, hold on a second. And then he got back on the phone and said, how soon can you be back with the phone? And so, again, like that close, you know? And so I went back, and a week later, I was on my way to Seattle with a 24-foot truck with the drum set in the back of it.
Oh, man. So when you made that move up there, the Seattle scene at that time was a pretty close knit scene, wasn't it? were all those bands awesome. Pretty close? I mean, because you're coming from out of town, jumping into that.
Well,
I mean, how did that?
Like my over? First day when I the first day I arrived in Seattle for the audition, I mean, the office of Pearl Jam management and like on one end of the office, 207 and a half Durst Street. It's like go up a 3-story walk up. And on one end was Kelly Curtis. On the other end was Susan Silver. Susan managed Soundgarden. Kelly managed Pearl Jam and both managed Alice Chains together. Also on the floor were Screaming Trees management and all these various Seattle bands. They were all in that same room. One big open room with a couple offices at Jen. And I mean, yeah, it was amazing. Like my first day arriving, I'm going up the stairs. I had gotten off the plane and I was about an hour early for the meeting. And so I putzed about in Pioneer Square. And then when I was going up the stairs, this really, just this like a sprightly, cute girl was coming down, and halfway down our path crossed and she just punched me in the stomach
just out of nowhere. Bow.
Yeah. And it was Demery, who's Lane Staley's girlfriend. And yeah, she socked me in the stomach and then laughed her ass off. And it was just like, wow, welcome to Seattle. And
you weren't laughing.
Oh yeah, I was. It was just, it was so, so unexpected. And the sound that I made cracked me up. Oh, you know, but,
that's funny.
You know, yeah, it was close knit and it was a trip, you know, I mean, we, when we left on our tour, I mean, everybody, Alice was heading out with Van Halen and Soundgarden was going out. I mean, everybody was going at the same time. So the office was just crazy, you know, everybody coming and going and getting, so, you know, it was a trip. It was such a fast paced thing that it's almost like we all didn't have a whole lot of time to think about it. We were just jumping in with both feet and going. And then, you know, it was always great. Like, you know, the next time I saw like Sean Kinney and those guys from Alice, we were in New Orleans, you know, and it was just, you know, it's just like we would run into each other on the road and it was always awesome. You know, and like we had made it a point a few times, shows and sound art crowd, and then of course we did the whole Lollapalooza thing, and so it was cool. Yeah, it was a close-knit community. But you know, even if I would have been there for years, it would have been the same, because even though it was close-knit, it was very kind of inverted group, you know? And no one was very extroverted. It was kind of, you know.
Yeah, and nobody was big at this time, right? This was before you having anybody broke. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
Soundgarden were the elder statesmen, you know?
Well, I saw Alice in Chains with Van Halen on that tour. And
that's cool, huh?
It's cool. But at the time, nobody really knew who they were, and they were getting boos. Mm-hmm. You know, did you guys run into that same kind of situation too, or were you accepted right away, pretty much?
We fought for it for the part. I mean, that's the reason, the only reason I kind of like, what the fuck about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, and the fact that supposedly they think I was accepted for that. It was the fact that when we went out, I mean, we went out with, you know, $250,000 worth of debt to try to pay off, and no promise of anything. No promise of success or that. And it was like, you know, the record label wanted us to go out with Ozzy Osbourne, because he's also on Epic.
Oh, man.
We said no to that.
That's probably a good choice.
We said no to that. Yeah, because it just didn't make any sense to us. And we, 14 of us in a 15-passenger van, you know, and the Chili Peppers asked us to jump in front of them for 30 minutes a night for $500 a show. And I mean, we borrowed money from our manager's brother, because since he said no to Ozzy, the record company, they weren't giving us any support at all. And the first record came out under developmental deal anyway, you know, like a handshake. So when our first tour, I mean, there were nights we played, you know, 500-seat place, and there was, you know, we played 250 fast clubs, and there was 150, you know, We, from the moment we first played together, and it was unspoken, we just busted ass. And every town that we played, every show that we played, it was literally that, you know, it would be like, who are they? And then, whoop, there'd be this little pow. And it was really amazing, because you could actually physically see things changing. So when we first went to Europe, our first show in London was like, Esplanade, which was, you know, 200 or 500 passing place, but there was a line around the building, you know, that affect that new agent. So but yeah, we were in Victoria, Canada, and I remember Jeff saying, you know, that, you know, we really the record was just about to come out, or it had just come out like before. And it was like, man, we got to sell at least 20,000. We're not going to get a chance to do another. You know, I mean, that's where we were at. And we just played our asses off. And when we got the Chili Peppers, I mean, he wouldn't touch the video. Nothing was happening. And we just worked our asses off. And you know, it just got to where, I mean, you can slowly see it happening. And then the day that our t-shirts outsold the Chili Peppers t-shirts in merchandise, that's like, okay, it's going well.
Something was happening, yeah.
Yeah. And then and like radio wasn't touching the music, and MTV wasn't. And then you know, the album sales were following us around. The show we did the next day, record company was getting orders for record, and before you knew it, MTV didn't have a choice but to play, and radio didn't have a choice but to play, because we had broken that threshold where they had to. Pretty amazing, you know, considering we did two, we had two videos. One of them was a live recording, black and white. Second video for that was another live show. And that just, MTV wasn't doing that at the time at all.
Yeah.
At all.
That's interesting to hear that story, because I have a lot of people from the rock scene prior to you, you know, from the 80s, early 90s. I have a lot of those guys on this show, and they, hearing their story of when you guys came onto the scene, it's interesting to hear your story from your point, you know, how you guys took over that scene.
Yeah. Well, it took us a long time, and it was a lot of work. And it was a trip, because we were playing, you know, 3 shows day off, 5 shows day off, 7 shows day off for almost 2 years. You know? And so we didn't, you know, and at the same time, we sold a couple million albums. We were still only paying ourselves $400 a month. You know, so we didn't really feel like we were taking over anything. You know, we were just working. We were just working.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. So once you guys did get that success, I mean, how did that affect you personally? Did it change
you? Fired from the band.
Well, a couple years later, we're not there yet, Dave.
No, it didn't change much. I mean, again, we were just working really hard, and you know, my girlfriend Sherry, you know, at the time she worked for the band, and you know, I got this little modest house and used car, and you know, I was able to pay off some friends' bills and shit like that, you know. But no, it didn't really. I think the only thing it changed was, like, you know, if I wanted to get a tattoo on my face, I could. I didn't feel like I was going to have to work my face out.
Yeah. So, yeah. How about the other guys? Did it affect them?
Yeah. You know, that was the it was. Yeah, very much so. You know, it was an interesting thing, you know, and it's an interesting thing to see and to feel. I mean, you know, it's like when you're working so hard towards something, group of people, and you're struggling together, you know, you're a tribe, you're working towards the same thing. And all of a sudden, you know, there was the ability for people to live where they wanted to live, how they wanted to live, and do what they wanted to do as individuals. And the first thing I noticed was that, you know, the band, we were such different individuals. But when we were behind our instruments and together, such an easy and unified thing, music came easy. The work wasn't work, even though we were all killing ourselves. We were working so well as a unit that it supported that. It was like everything that I put in, every time I broke a finger or whatever, it was worth it, you know? Like, for what I was motivated by or what I wanted to do, and how I felt about things, like all the sacrifices were worth it, all the rewards were deserved. So, but then there came a time, I mean, you know, I remember doing an interview with Eddie where during the interview, I was like, you know, it was so drastic from, there was just so many different dynamics and it was so drastic. And I remember afterwards, you know, I was like, what the fuck was that? His response was, I was just fucking, but it was really just, you know, it was like we all had to develop our shell, I guess, our way of protecting ourselves from whatever it was. So everyone was always asked this at the time, like, how are you dealing with pressure? How do you find the pressure? And it was like, me, I didn't put pressure. I put more pressure on myself than I would allow anyone else to put on, you know? So I actually felt like the pressure, you know, this ain't shit compared to the pressure I felt like I was trying to feed myself, you know? Like, no, I spent my whole life, you know, developing muscles, you know, and the ability to do what I do. And I worked so hard to get to a point where I could just say, wow, this is what I do, you know, and I can have a healthy and happy life and do things for people I care about, take care of myself because of what I've always wanted to do. So I, you know, to me, the pressure had already happened, but it's different for different people, you know, and persona is something of, to me, I didn't really feel like I had, you know, I didn't have walls around my house, you know, and people would come up, take pictures in the windows, you know, we put up the stuff that made it to where if you took a picture in the window of my house, it just reflected the camera back to you, you know. It was like, but I didn't put up walls. When people would come up and, you know, be standing in the street, I'd invite them up and cook them fucking salmon. You know what I mean? It was like, to me, it was not a trip, but other people in the band, you know, they had their own thing and persona isn't enough to defend yourself, you know? It's just, yeah. I'm trying not to say anything too mean about anything, but what it comes down to is people, you know, there was a point where Eddie had to be Eddie and everyone else, you know, had to let him.
Mm-hmm. Is that when you first noticed that your relationship with him was starting to, you guys are starting to separate?
I always respected Eddie as a singer, excuse me, and as a performer, all that stuff, you know, I mean, incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I never really, you know, felt like he was all that genuine and like we could connect when it was the two of us, but when anyone was around, I felt like and so when it did finally come down to where, again, excuse me, that came out, you know, it was like I was the only one that didn't roll my eyes at some of the bullshit. I said, why, you know, or all that stuff. And so it was just kind of one of those things. But yeah, it was just, I never expected that anyone would mess with what we had going as far as internally, you know. And I certainly never thought that men cowardly enough to not stand up and try to keep the band from becoming, you know, anything.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, going into recording Verses, that was your first time with, well, not the first time in the studio because you recorded a few songs with them before. But the first album with them.
Yeah. And to me, it was, you know, I mean, we spent, you know, we got off the road and spent a few months kind of woodshedding, which was, you know, me and Stone showing up early and him playing riffs and playing along, and then the guys coming in and us just jamming, reandering it. And the way we did the first record, we left it open. You know, we didn't really finish song. We got great ideas and we were determined that when we got to the studio, we would finish them then to keep it fresh. You know,
that can be expensive.
No.
No.
Nah. No, we wake up at 10:30 in the morning. We'd start recording. You know, a lot of that record in my headphones, click track. And when I felt like I played the song well, I'd lean over to my bike and say, that was the song. And by dinner time, they had overdone them. So that was pretty quick. I mean, even Eddie worked really quick lyrically. That was the slowest part of the record. But still, I mean, a lot of bands, you know, the drum tracks are done and months later, they're still working on lyrics. But no, we were in the studio for a couple of months and the record was done.
Didn't you guys switch studios for that record? Did you move?
No. We went from Gallery of Potato Head, which was our little 7-foot ceiling rehearsal space in the basement of an art gallery in Seattle. We went from there to Nicasio, San Rafael, or, you know, north of San Rafael site. Yeah, the Vitalogy record did kind of.
Okay. I thought in the during verses, isn't that where you went and you like loved it? It was like paradise, and then Eddie did not like it.
Well, and that was the thing about, you know, Eddie's trip, where somebody had asked me what I thought about, you know, I think it was Cameron Crowe asking, but I thought about, like, look at this place, it's incredible, you know, it's beautiful, and you know, I didn't know we were supposed to be upset about that, but yeah, I mean, it was Northern California, springtime, incredible. And I don't think Eddie, you know, it's just like everything else back then, you know. You've been cover of a magazine, but you have to cover a magazine, you know, the way it was. So, but yeah, no, it was a beautiful place. But definitely the polarization of Eddie and I started at that point, you know, and it was kind of nurtured. You could see it, like, you know, everyone else was just doing what they did. And on one hand, someone would say, what do you think? And it's like, fuck, this place is great. Of course, Eddie's like, oh, you know, how can you write a rock record in a place like, well, we sure did, you know, not to mention that 10 record was done at Ridge Farm, which, talk about over the top, incredible place. I mean, but no one asked Eddie in an article what he thought about that.
Yeah. Well, I think Versus was your best record. I think you brought another edge to the band with your playing. And I think that continued on to Vitalogy. And then as soon as you were out of the band, in my opinion, I think they lost that edge again.
Mm-hmm.
Although 10 is a great record, it just didn't have that energy that you added to it.
No, 10 was a great record. And Jim Palmer is amazing. I'll say that. The guy who picked 10 record. They spent a few months at Beach Farm. Jim is an incredible guy, incredible producer and engineer. And, you know, I mean, he worked on some of the most influential and awesome you know, he doesn't get enough credit for what he did on the 10 record. But it, you know, the Vitalogy record, in my opinion, the cassette that I had before I got kicked out of the band, that record was, to me, the best Pearl Jam record ever.
Vitalogy?
The version I had, the way it sounded. You know, it had the same kind of qualities of Verses, but way more honest sounding and soulful. But it was, you know, it was a record that would have made Pearl Jam bigger. And it was, I was fired, and from what I understand Eddie was given free reign.
So when they let you go, I mean, how did that all go down? I mean, you had to be as shocked as
I was, right? I was shocked as shit. Yeah, well, you know, we had talked about doing maybe, you know, I had mentioned maybe something more, a little less guitar oriented on the next, you know, record and blah, 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 all this stuff. And, you know, we did our last show and the Versus tour in New York, Paramount. And I remember after the show, I mean, that tour to me, that those shows, that band was incredible. And after the show, I went, you know, saying goodbye to everybody because I was taking off. And I went and found Eddie. He was talking to Ace Frehley. And I waited patiently, you know, for my bandmate to look over at me and so I could say, see you in Seattle. And it took so long that Ace really eventually looked over at me like, what's this guy standing here for? You know, it was like that. And so I said, Eddie, I'll see you, you know, good show, good tour. I'll see you in Seattle. And he didn't say a word. He just looked at me because he knew already that I was gone. You know, he knew before that show, he knew the whole time. And I'll never forget that. You know, that was like, showed me a lot about it, that he could be like that. And so, you know, when I got back, you know, it was already kind of an uneasy feeling, but it's not something that I ever would consider happening. You know, I spoke to my manager, Samson, and Eddie and him were on their way to airport to go down to New Orleans to take care of that thing where Eddie had got some sort of scuffle with somebody. And, you know, Eddie was in the car with Kelly, the manager, and it's like, okay, well, blah, 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 blah. And then as I was hanging up, Kelly was like, oh, wait, wait, wait. And I put the phone back to my car and said, you know, give Stone a call. You want to talk to him. I said, okay. I called Stone. We decided to eat breakfast the next day. And I thought we were discussing, you know, what we were going to do next. And he came in. He sat down. I was like, Dave Abrams, we're looking for another drummer. That was it.
Just like that.
Just like that. But at least he had the fucking balls to be mad about it. So from what I found out later, Eddie's suggestion was to have lawyers do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that happens a lot that way.
Yes, it's ridiculous, but it's not, you know, I wouldn't have thought it. I'll always respect Stone for doing that because I know, I mean, the experience we had together after he said that was pretty emotional.
Sure, sure. So and, at this point, you know, at this point now, I mean, what's going through your head? Did you have plans? It probably took you a little bit to come up with what you were going to do, right? I mean, what was going through your head at that time?
It was just way too much. It over. Yeah. It was just like, what the fuck? I mean, I called. First thing I did was called my girlfriend at the time, Sherry, and I was like, how they fucking fired me? She was like, what? And then I called my best friend, you know, of many, many years, and told him in his first response, I said, oh, man, I just got fired. Man, I never fired anything. And his response, without missing a beat, he said, good. You never fucking quit that fucking band anyway. And I was just like, whoa. You know, it took me a long time to understand that, right, you know, that you know, I did feel underappreciated. I did feel like, you know, like there was a dynamic that was wrong, element of the band, in that, you know, like I was the only one that celebrated our success. I was the only one that, like, you know, record went gold. My reaction was, holy shit, this is awesome. And I ended up on a payphone with the crew back at the hotel saying, hey, and all of us were celebrating while the rest of the guys were sitting at a table quietly eating their food. bummed out. I just thought, wow, we paid off our debt. Yeah, it was like, why can't you celebrate what we've worked so hard for? You know, I mean, I remember when Kelly mentioned, our manager mentioned, oh, by the way, the album went gold. That's how it was while we were eating together. And at the moment he said that, I was still making sure that one of my fingers was the knuckle still in place. I was like, you know, ow. You know, because I just trying to bend it. We had another show, for fuck's sake, you know? And he said that. And I just remember that my the voice in my head said, it's worth it, you know? And I looked up from my hand and no one else was smiling. You know? And that's what my friend meant. I was like, look, you know, you don't feel like, you feel like you earned what you got. And everyone else seems like they're entitled. You know, you're proud of the work that you did, and everyone else, you know, seems like doesn't matter. You know, it's just like one of those things where, and that was the trip. And when I got fired, it was just like, but it was so intense at that point, you know, and I didn't, it was like, I mean, everything was new. You know, money was new. Everything was different. And, you know, the last time I sat down and was just me by myself, not, you know, when I was Dave rather than Dave Pearl Jam, was when I went to Seattle. You know, I became Dave's new guy, Dave Pearl Jam. And here I was back, and I was sitting there going, what the fuck, you know? And I was right back to that same place that I was before, like, where I really want to do this anymore. And luckily enough, I went down to Texas with Dave Castell, that producer who gave Pat my number, went into his studio, scooped up Gary Muller, scooped up Paul Slavens, the singer for Ten Hands, Matt Chamberlain's band that I was talking about before, Edie, and Daryl Phillips from Dr. Tongue, and Doug Neal, and all these people that I admired so much, and I drug them all into a studio, and we just started recording. Like, wow, this is fantastic. And so I basically said, you know, I had the wherewithal to say, what would it take for each of you to give me a year of your life? And we found this ranch on 600 acres and, you know, turned it into a studio, and all these guys took a year off from what they were doing. And we just, like a bunch of kids with the most elaborate toys in the world, got together and it was awesome. So, and as Paul Slavin put it, it saved me.
So when the word got out that you were no longer in the band, did you get other offers from bands? Did people call you wanting you?
Yeah. The first thing, you know, many, and still to this day. But you know, music was so personal and so much of my identity with myself at the time, based around music, and to be fired like that, it shook more of me. I was 20s, but I'd never really had to grow up. I left school way early. My social scene was basically, you know, behind my kid. So, it was like all of a sudden I was, you know, an adult. In an adult environment, but still I was a kid, you know. And so it was tough because there was a lot of anxiety and there was just a lot of emotions that I had no fucking clue what they were or what, you know, how to deal with them. And I became afraid of putting myself in a vulnerable position. And the first call, like Abe Laboriel Jr., drummer for Paul McCartney now, and his father, running the bass player, got in touch with me 2 weeks after I got fired. and he usually tours with Steve Gadd and all these, and I was like my heroes again. And he said, "Dave, come on, let's go to Europe. You know, come on, we'll just throw a kid on your back and we'll travel by train and we'll do some improv shows." And it was like, you know, that's a legend asking me to take the seat of a legend. And I couldn't do it. I didn't have the heart. And I got a lot of different things that came up, but I was in that same place where I was afraid, you know, really literally. I was just fearful of yeah, everything just seemed too much at that time. And it took me many years to kind of like settle into figuring out who I was. I was about to grow up, you know. And you know, in that time also, my attorney was also a Guns N' Roses attorney. She had told me that Axl wanted to talk about, you know, joining Guns and all this stuff. And so that came about. Axl and I, you know, spoke a whole bunch and that we worked towards that play a little bit, all that stuff. But again, that, you know, it was weird when I started doing that. You know, the important thing to me was, you know, that literally Kelly Curtis, Pearl Jam's manager, and you know, I was heartbroken. Really. You know, I didn't look at anything like business. I didn't see business as business. I you know, everything was relationship between people. And I was shocked that he was able to, and the band were able to kind of cast me to the side and then treat me so fucking badly to protect their business, you know. You know, still to this day, when I see the quote that Jeff Heyman said that I was more comfortable with the rock star than blah, 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 and that's why I was, you know, it was like that. I still, it's like, this is the most ridiculous fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. So, but that sort of stuff. And so, when I was talking to Guns N' Roses management about, you know, connecting and doing all this stuff, I was honest about, you know, Big Machine. I just, you know, like, I've already been chewed up and spit out, and I'm not really a guy again. But at one point, you know, when we were working on music, I was Doug, management for GNR, said, you know, "What do you think?" And I was like, "Well, I think maybe, you know, this music, it's not really Guns N' Roses. Maybe Axl should do his own thing." You know, it was like the idea was me and Podboy, Linus Nails on drums, double drummer, more electric, you know, Robin Faint from Nine Inch Nails on guitar, which is incredible. Duff was still there at the time. Dizzy was still there at the time. And Axl was actually there at the time at rehearsals. And, you know, it was like,
that's nice.
It was an amazing thing. Yeah. And I really like that guy. I like him a lot. But it got to a point where it wasn't making sense, you know, that it was, you know, it was like the ideas that were being thrown around musically and then playing a Guns N' Roses song was like, "Wow, this is a weird thing." And so I'd mentioned that, and management said, "Well, here's the deal, you know, just go along with it. We're, you know, the basically the idea was let Axl do his thing without Flash, and you know, when it doesn't succeed, then maybe that'll be his motivation, get Slash back, and that'll be your in, because he doesn't want Matt back." And I was like, "What the fuck?" I mean, that went against, it was like the opposite of what, you know, what I was part of, and it put me in this really terrible position. So I'd gotten to know Axl in such a way where I had a lot of respect for what he was wanting to do. And I also understood the amount of courage it took for him not only to want to do it after what he had been through, but for him to be so dedicated to, you know, to just be willing to be Axl Rose, you know, again. You know, he's a fucking tough motherfucker, but he's sensitive. Fucking, you know, he's a real dude. And but to hear that when management said that to me, it put me in this position of like, I can't be honest. You know? He and I were in my car, this rental car that I had, and I was driving around in LA with him, and I wanted to tell him so bad. I wanted to say, look, man, you're being fucked. This is how they're playing you. And because this guy, you know, it's like I play music with my friends. I'm not a guy. I'm not a drummer in a fucking, you know, like that. It doesn't work that way. And so all of a sudden I realized about myself that, wow, I'm not, you know, music isn't a business. But this guy, I've got a choice to make right now. Either I can embrace this incredible contract that they're willing to give me and all this money and all this shit. And all, you know, Axel was giving me a lot of power and decisions. And as a businessman, I would have, because business is shitty, I would have said, yeah, great, fuck it, whatever, it matters. But business decision, like versus, you know, buying another house and having a future that's set and all this stuff. Sure, business wise, fuck them. You know, mm-hmm. But this was my fucking friend who we were about to go to war together against the world. He wanted Guns N' Roses bigger war. And it's like, man, we're not going to do that unless we're like this, you know? And so it was like, I had to quit. I had to tell, and I couldn't tell him why. Because I didn't want to shake his foundation either.
Sure, he asked, right?
No, I didn't give him the chance to ask. I wrote him a letter. I told him, no, I said it in a way that didn't give him the chance. I told him I wanted to be a musician first, rock first. Then I did that on purpose because I knew that that his reaction was fury. That his reaction was saying that infuriating, and it was. I got a call from my friend Kim at Rolling Stone, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, why?" I just got off the phone with Axel, and I'm like, "Oh, how is he?" And
how's he doing?
And then my phone rang, and no shit, I put it down on the table, and Sherry and I sat on the couch, and Axel went off on a stream of consciousness rant of like my own personal non-music fucking angry Axel Guns N' Roses show. He was letting me have it, and that was that. You know? But yeah, it was heartbreaking, really, because I had begun to develop a relationship where I felt like he trusted me and I trusted him. And that was, we spent many, many months cultivating relationships even before we played together. Because that trust was so important to him, you know? And even when we decided that it was going to work after we got together and jammed, he wanted paper between us before we started working on music, you know, because his trust was violated before, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it really, yeah, that's when I kind of went, eh. Yeah. Big machine and the whole business of rock and roll and music.
Sure. You know, it's understandable with what you've been through.
Yeah. And it just, it's yucky, you know, but it's interesting now, 55 years old. And I feel like as far as my playing, better than ever, as far as my headspace and how I feel about, you know, myself and relationships, people I meet and relationships that I have and all that stuff. I feel more prepared now to do what I did in my 20s than ever. So we'll see how the body holds up, but I feel like, you know, in the next year or two, I'll be taking steps towards getting out and making money back.
Right. You froze up. Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Axel afterwards?
No, I've never, you know, and it's only in the last 6 months that I've actually let the truth of that situation go.
Okay.
I haven't spoken about it at all many, many years. But you know, it's like I've always wanted to, you know, now that I see Guns out and doing their thing, and I saw a video of them performing, and it was just a look in his eye and just his demeanor that I felt like at this point, his life won't be damaging, say what I had to say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and fuck, I mean, you know, who am I? It's like, it's a business, you know? And it was a business decision that had millions and millions and millions of dollars behind it for that manager and that record label to do what they did. And lo and behold, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Worked the way they wanted it to. And I saw Axl performing and I just thought, you know what? Yeah, it won't, it, you know, at this point, hopefully, if he ever hears it, maybe it'll just be one little piece of his heart that he's able to get back. You know, I can't imagine I take up a whole lot of space, but at the same time, I did, you know, I really did and do care about that. So
yeah
you know, it's time. I felt like it's enough time has passed that the truth be told that won't hurt anybody.
Sure Now before we froze up, you did say in the next couple of years or so you would get back out there. That's where we were at.
Yeah,
when froze.
Yeah, I feel like I have something to offer, and even more important, I feel like it's time. You know, there's some other things that will come out in time, you know, about things that have happened in my life and all this stuff. But right now, it's safe to say that, you know, if the universe is willing, I'll put shit out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to see you back out there. I watch your YouTube channel with you recording your drum sessions and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So amazing.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, man. I still love playing, you know, as much as ever, you know. And biggest thing is that, you know, my relationship to music is, and always has been, you know, a direct mirror of my relationship with myself. And yeah. So.
Did I hear correctly, as far as other artists go, that Joe Satriani gave you a call at one point and you kind of told him to go pack sand or something?
Yeah. No, I fucked up, man. Yeah, he had called me and I'll be honest here. I'll be honest. He had called me, and at the time I was doing way too much blow, you know? And so I had just an air of myself that was like, I remember the phone call and I looked back at it with embarrassment as well as, you know, a chuckle. But here I'm talking to Joe Satriani on the phone, and he's wanting me to come in and work on his next record with him. And he had worked with Jonathan Hoover by, you know, Beck Bensley. Actually, side note, Jonathan Hoover was the one who went down the hill at the site and got the snare drum I threw up Phil after recording the movie. But I was telling Joe, like, you know, yeah, your last records were so mechanical sounding. Maybe we got to do something raw and just go in there and the fuck am I?
What'd he say?
Not much.
He wasn't expecting that answer, right? That reaction.
No, but really what it was, you know, as well as the drugs, was all just a part of me reacting to that fear that I spoke of earlier. You know, I was looking for a way to justify the fact that I wasn't mature enough, that I wasn't able to deal with or find a way to understand kind of what I did. So, you know, trip. I dumbed myself for a while, and then I went the other way and worked with incredible guy Martin Bullard for a couple of years on you know, understanding who the fuck I was. Yeah, it was awesome. But you know, before that, yeah, I was trying everything just so normal, you know. So, yeah, crazy.
Well, I'm glad to see you're still playing drums, because I know you do some stuff here and there, right? One-off stuff for people, and you still doing that kind of thing?
Always in session, doing tons of sessions and working on my own music, which I just do for my kid. Best way to myself.
Let me ask you this. I know you've addressed this issue before, but with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how that went down. I know you've talked about that, but since that time has passed, have you gotten past that kind of, or is that still?
I never, it's interesting. A lot of people, when they read the words that I've written on social media, they put a bitterness to them that I don't have.
Okay.
And I've tried hard to, I quit school when I was 14 years old, but I managed to somehow be able to express myself. I feel like it's the point across, but social media is a weird thing. People use voice in their head. People that don't know me, they assume that I'm bitter or upset. So instantly, it's that attitude, words that I write about that. My whole thing with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was, it's just,
it's what?
So hard. That it's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
We worked so hard as a band. And literally, at the time the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame happened, over 50% of what they were doing live, I wrote. And all of the success that they had, or athlete albums, all that stuff that I did.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking. And Dave Cruzan, he's a great guy. I've gotten to know him really well, but had exchanges and communicate together. And I like the guy a lot. And for them to say that, that they only recognize people who made contributions to the band success, it's like, to me, it was such a slap in the face, and I was surprised that the band still didn't stand up.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, it said a lot to me about that I didn't, and I don't know what it was that kept that from being point of contention. I mean, that band that I was fought for, mm-hmm. just right and won always.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really surprised. And I just can't help, along with many other business clients, that,
yeah.
I just think it's wrong.
Yeah. No, I agree.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the world knows that you, out of all the drummers, you probably made the biggest contribution to that band.
Well, Stone Gossard said they'd have been just as successful with any other drummer.
I don't think so. And I think you brought something to them.
I don't either. And that in itself is something that still, I think if there's anything that still hits you the wrong way, it's the thing that they might do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think you ever talk to those guys again?
I don't know. I wouldn't have a problem with it, I don't know. It's funny, people ask me all the time if I've talked to any of them, and I haven't. I've talked to Matt and Dave Cruzan and Jack Iron, but I haven't spoken or heard from any band in many, many, many years.
Yeah. Well, maybe when you get back out there in a year or two, you'll cross paths again. And
well, it'd be amazing. I mean, I've always had the high hope to perform some of those songs again, the audience of the band, but I mean, it is what it's
about. Yeah.
But it'd be fun.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to talk to you too about your Free Association Records. Is that something you still got going?
You know, it was just kind of a, you know, with the GRO guys, you know, it was kind of the way I functioned. Like, you know, when I had my commercial studio, I didn't charge people for work in it. So it's just like, it, to me, it's a free ass record.
Mm. But yeah.
What it's always been called. It was just basically, you know, kind of a tongue in cheek thing about my accountant telling me when I was sending out the Green Romance Orchestra CDs, people would send me a check to the PO box, and I would, you know, they'd send me there's so many of them had nice letters attached to them, and I would answer the letter on the check, put the check in with a couple of CDs and mail it off. And my accountant at the time was like, what are you doing? You know, it's like for every order you get, you send out two or three albums and you send the check back. So I was like, eh, you know,
the opposite of what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. So it became kind of a running joke, and you know, I've never run it like a label or anything. It's just basically
okay.
A moniker. Yeah. The ass record.
Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, listen, it's been an honor to talk to you, Dave.
Well, it was a treat. I enjoyed it. You know, I actually, when I went to sleep last night, I had worked a bunch. I've been doing a lot of mixing, and I got into this flow last night on this work, and when I looked up and the sun was coming, like, oh fuck. And so I went to sleep, or tried to, but I was like, every hour I was like looking at the alarm, like, oh shit, I didn't want to be late or miss it, you know. That's why I finally said, ah, fuck it, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, let's do it. And when I was in the shower, I was like, man, you know, hey, you can be sleepy and honest. It's easy.
Yeah.
It's like that. It made me feel really good about where I'm at in my life, that I don't have to be rested and on my game, because I live my life pretty straightforward and honest days. So,
yeah. Nice. You seem happy. Yeah. You seem happy.
I am. You know, it's like, yeah, like I said, it's, I've had in my life has been, it reads really well. And the chapters are thick and way diverse. And at this point, the benefit of, like I said at the beginning, my folks teaching me to pay attention paid off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Except for these goddamn, I got my motorcycle ride. I hit a fucking big hole in the road. My teeth just clack and two teeth came out. No. Yeah. Ugh. So I've got that going for me. But I hate the dentist, but I figure I got to get it fixed, because it's just, you know, the look that's not working for me.
Yeah. Well, as we get older, we care less about those type of things.
Yeah,
right?
You know, yeah, that's true. Excuse me. Wow, this cold is killing me.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. It's nice to meet you. Thanks for the thoughtful questions and the patience to allow me to answer them.
Yes, sir.